6 in the review of communications for the United States Coast Guard cutter Itasca during June and July 1937, being done by Elgin Long. And tape number 6 is starting out with an interview with Captain W.L. Sutter, which we are going to call his tape number 3. We're side 1, tape number 3. And this interview was done with Captain Sutter on July 23rd, 1977. Interview with Captain William L. Sutter, S-U-T-T-E-R. What does the L stand for?
Lewis.
Lewis, L-O-U-I-S. At 561A East Front Street, Plainfield, New Jersey, 07060. Captain Sutter's wife, Helen, is with us, and we're in their living room. And my wife, Marie, is here. And this is the 23rd, Saturday afternoon, almost 2 o'clock in the afternoon, July 23rd, 1977. Captain Sutter's phone number is area code 201-757-5445. We've just looked at a picture of the plane table and had Allidate showing Captain Sutter, then an ensign aboard the Coast Guard cutter Itasca, and probably Ensign Mellon or Ensign Swanston operating the Allidate, and they're surveying during the survey they made, and the results of that survey were quite dramatic.
Oh, yes, the islands had shaped considerably from the charts we were using. Okay. I say the charts we were using around 1890 to early 1900, I can't remember which.
And the accuracy of watches and whatnot. And
well, and also, Swanson was the one that fixed the position of the island. And I can't remember, there were three of them we used to visit all the time. That they're anywhere from 20 to 30 miles out of position.
Wow. Okay, now.
Oh, no, but the charts we were using then, but we made this plane table survey, and after we made the survey, and Swanson fixed the position, we sent all the data to the hydrographic office. They published new charts after that.
Yeah, but when did the charts come out?
That I couldn't say.
Okay.
I wanted to say they made, but not by Tom Earhart, but I'm not sure.
Were you aware of a letter that Commander Kenner sent?
No,
that
I
made
don't.
All this information confidential?
No, I don't.
You're not aware of that?
No. What information is that? What the position of the island?
Can you explain? Yeah.
Well, this is part of what happened out there. On the plane table, I got digging. And then I found out that this was all, you completed the survey in Holland, I even have the time, on afternoon August, I'll say 16, 1936, that's right, within a couple of days. And deduced all the data, and by a matter of fact, I have the chart that Swanson made en route. And then I have, I found in the National Archives, the cover letter that, you know, now Kenner was captain on that cruise,
yep.
Of the Itasca, and the cover letter, made all of the information confidential because they wanted to make sure it was checked out before it was disseminated, because they weren't sure. I mean, it'd be proper to let the proper authorities check all the information out, making sure it was proper.
It's a rather crude survey.
And he gave the old position of the islands and the new position of the islands, and it was forwarded. There was 12 copies, I think. Don't hold me to the number of copies. There's something like 12 copies made and told where every copy went to. And, of course, once they were made confidential, they were all kept track of, and I traced them all down. And I just happen to have a friend who's in intelligence for the Army Map Service, the old Army Map Service now, the Mapping Service in St. Louis. And the charts didn't come out until 1939, showing the new position of the islands.
Oh.
Well, you know, it takes it takes a while.
Well, one thing I would like to make clear, because this is very important, you at no time were aware or knew anything about whether any of this information was actually given to Amelia Earhart.
No, I would have no way of knowing.
You would have no way of knowing that. But you in no way were responsible to see that she got it or anything like that.
Oh, no. As I say, I don't know where Kenner sent this letter, to the Coast Guard headquarters or hydrographic officer, who it was. But then it's up to them to put out the chart. As I say, our survey was very rough. It's probably the crudest survey you can make.
But, well, I traced out and actually found a photograph. I found the receipt that Noonan... He bought all his charts down in San Pedro, and he bought them in March of 1937. And I actually, he'd been rolling the charts out and looking at the newspaper people, and I actually found a photograph of the chart that he was using on that for that flight, and from it was able to identify which one it was. And of course, it was a chart of 1931. Of what that he was using, so it had the old positions of the islands on it. And this is part of what happened out there.
It was just one of those circumstances.
One of those things, you know.
One of those
what are you going to do? But anyway, that's why, then now we have in front of us here this the Fraser chart of the United States Coast Guard at sea, Pacific Ocean, July 1937. Commanding officer tasked with Commander San Francisco Division, radio transcripts, air hour flight. And as you were telling me that. That you had made up most of the communications part of this study, and then Commander Lieutenant Commander Lee Baker, who was the executive officer. You turn him over to him.
Yeah, and I don't know what he edited, and he turned him over to the captain. I know the captain, both of them had edited the whole report, and I don't know what they edited. What they didn't edit.
Then I mentioned to you that you were desperately trying to get her to tell you some schedules and frequencies that she wanted. And luckily, all of those communications, we've been able to find them all and tie them all down. But the reason she was reticent to tell you was because her radio wasn't working. She just didn't know what she was going to do. She delayed the flight a week, which was... bad because the flight was very well planned, but by delaying it for a week, for one thing, they lost the moon. The moon would have been almost full if she'd have been on schedule, but she got so far behind schedule, the moon was about 25 days old and was just a sliver and didn't come up until about 2 o'clock in the morning. Didn't amount to much, and so wouldn't help her avoid all those clouds out there all night or give them a good bright object to shoot through. She'd planned to fly to the use of the moon, and unfortunately, because of the delay in Bandung, Java. Well, the next thing that happens is she arrives in Darwin, Australia, and bless his heart, I went to Australia last year, and I found Wing Commander,
Rose,
and he was head of the direction finder station or radio station at Darwin. And when she came in, he'd sent her a message at the stop before and asking her to communicate with him on such and such and whatnot, and she didn't do it. And so he asked her why, and she said, well, she kind of beat around the bush. And then she finally admitted her radio had packed up and wasn't working. And he said, well, if you want, I'll have a go at it and take a look at it. And she said, yeah, please. And he did, and he found a blown fuse in the receiver power supply, and he replaced it, checked it out, seemed to work all right, and he gave her a couple, three spare fuses, and he said, if it packs up again, why don't you replace the fuse? And as far as we know, her receiver worked relatively well from then on.
Of course, as far as we were concerned, we felt the flight wasn't very well planned. They said go to Honolulu and from there. Get further instruction. I don't know exactly. But we just had no idea what frequency rate, the radio frequency she covered. And, at one time, we thought she had the green band radio, 365 to 500 on to contact merchant ship. But we found out later, it's only rumor, that she had that taken off in Miami, somewhere down the line. Because our radio direction planner was working very well, we could see it carrying 500. So we didn't have any idea. They gave a certain frequency, but what all those frequencies. Then another thing, we didn't know when takeoff date was, or the printer ran out of fuel waiting for it. And of course, Colorado came down a couple days after she reported missing fuel, and also we didn't know if she'd taken off and weighed, I guess 3 or 4 hours. I don't know how we got the information. We didn't get it from her. She was in the airplane.
Well, now this is one of the areas that I wonder if you've ever wondered about, because when I never thought anything about it until I started doing the communication study. You were trying to set up direct communications with Lay.
Well, we did have direct communication with Lay.
Well, I meant point to point, just between the ship and the radio station.
No, we had it because we were acting as a relay. Putnam was sending messages all the time, and we would get them out of the NMC, and we would pass them on to Lay to her. So we had point to point with Lay. But Lay never told us. I don't know how we found out that she did. Maybe Lay did tell us about this. 3 or 4 hours.
It's in here. But now on the point-to-point relay and the logs are, this is 40 years ago.
Yeah, right. I may be wrong. But
a little bit of fallibility memory is allowed.
We did relay a lot of Putnam messages.
I think most of it was done through Tutuila. And they went through Suva and up to Rabaul and down there. And it took about 4 hours to get a message.
Oh, and then we didn't have point to point.
Yeah, but you were trying to establish point to point, and she advised you that Commander Thompson, point blast asked, "What is the call sign of Lay?" I'll find it here. And she sent a message to you, and it's absolutely, you know, what the message said. She said the call sign was PAE, Papa Alpha Echo. And your radio operators kept hearing PAE once in a while, and she set up an actual schedule for you to call on 24 meters and to listen on, I don't know, 34 meters out of some, it's all in here. And the only thing that's kind of confusing about the whole thing is that, just a second, let me find it.
We've not been able to trace the call sign letter.
038, form PAE from NRUI, etc. Form task attempt, contact Lay direct and give Earhart latest weather. The attempt was unsuccessful in 25 meters. At 545, heard PAE, so gave him a call, unsuccessful. Well, the logs show something completely, show something different than that, but I think I know enough radio operator lingo and whatnot to figure out kind of what happened. But anyway, there's two things that confuse me. One is PAE is not a radio call sign of anything that I can ascertain.
Hmm.
Now, I know that aboard the ship you had the burn, what they call
burn
the burn list.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. That's what makes me rather curious. We didn't know what to call sign, because burn list contains a list of all the shore stations, all the ship stations.
The entire world.
Right.
And well, you're right.
We had a burn list.
You had probably the latest burn list, which was probably 1936 or something, or maybe 37. But
would have been might have been 36. I don't know how often they come out.
Whichever one you have, but it doesn't make any difference. I've looked through them all, and there never was, up until World War II, a call sign, a CW call sign, ever assigned to Lay. As a matter of fact, when I went to Amalgamated Wireless, they never could come up with one. I went to the Australian government, they couldn't come up with one. I talked to some of the radio operators, and some of them came up with VJ. But a P designates a Dutch station.
Yeah, the first one to tell what nation it is.
And I find it rather kind of strange that Leo Bellarts was an experienced radio operator. He should have known that there no British station would be a P. As a matter of fact, I've mentioned this to guys like Bob. His call sign, he said, well, that's a Dutch station. I mean, any radio operator knows these things. I mean, this is what
there couldn't be any mix-up on the letter because a P and a V are two different ones. They've got three dots from a dash for a B. Two dashes and a dot for a P.
I could see this happening very easily. P-A-E, or maybe there was no call sign, and she just said, Lay, L-A-E. Well, that's did-ah-did-did-ah-did. And the other is did-ah-da-did-did-ah-did. Well, there's only a difference between did-did-ah-did or did-ah-did-did and did-ah-da-did. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Well, that'd be very simple. Or it could get transposed.
Right.
And it was relayed to about four different radio stations, and any one of them pick up the wrong character. So I wonder if she just didn't spell out Lay, and somehow somebody turned the L into a P, and it... But but on the other hand, how could they hear him?
How was he getting a PAE? When you say there's nothing listed in the burn list on the PAE.
Nor was there ever anything listed for Lay. It's strange.
An Australian station that was run by the Protectorate government or whatever was there at the time. Would not have been the same.
Well, the New Guinea was under Australian control at the time. Well, the strange part, that's one thing that's not strange, it's just unexplained.
Yeah, right.
And
I can't explain.
Okay, I can't either. I've studied it for weeks, and I can't explain where that PAE came from or why it was never questioned. And what makes it even more confusing, they heard PAE. In the logs, they heard him and gave him a call. In this report, it says unsuccessful, but in the logs, they did make contact. They made contact with PAE, whoever he is. And the radio operators themselves made contact. Now, as you and I know, radio operators don't make up messages.
No.
They just sit there and establish contact. Messages are made and sent for and to officers or people who have the authority to make up messages.
Right.
But what actually happened, the radio operator heard him, he gave him a call, and the guy came back and he asked him, do you have any messages for me? And he said, no, I don't have any messages for you. Do you have anything for me? And he said, no, I don't have any message for you either. Okay, well, I'll see you later. Right, good morning. And they exchanged salutations and whatnot and checked it either, and you evidently had no file of messages standing by to be transmitted to Lay. And Lay, or whoever PAE is, had no messages standing by them, so they exchanged operator greetings and said, see you later. Which, is rather tragic because they'd been trying desperately to stab it, but the radio operators who were on duty at the time, they didn't have anything on the clipboard that had to go, and so the question was, do you have any messages? And the answer is, no, I don't. And yet, it's the middle of 5:45 in the morning, but what he should have woke you up and said, I got Lay, is there anything we should do with that, sir?
Yeah, right.
But
evidently he'd been a little too gruff on them. They wouldn't wake you up in the middle of the night.
Okay. Any thoughts on that at all?
No, I had no thoughts at all.
Did you ever?
As I say, I forgot now, but I was thinking we had drug contact with them, but certainly didn't.
Okay, I'm just trying to jog your memory, and if any of it does come back to you at all, I just want to set the record straight. I don't care what,
yes,
you know, what it is, what the record is, just as long as it's straight, because like I said earlier, you're about the last person left in the world that could set anything straight. So.
But after 40 years.
Yeah, I know. But that's not a big deal. I knew it just doesn't really matter.
You have no recollection of what that call sign
was,
where it could have come from.
No, I have no idea.
Well, you see, when did you graduate? What class?
35.
35. And had you been communication officer before joining the TASCA?
No, later.
Were you battery officer before that, or remember that the way you started out?
No, you started off as commissary officer, and the communication officer back then got commissary. It could be reversed. Could be government and communication. I don't think I was ever battery officer.
Had you had at this time? July 1937, had you had much experience as communication officer besides, you know, the training received at the academy?
No, about the communication officer go on leave or something like that, then I would succeed him.
But of course, your job is, as communication officer, is mainly administrative, while at the academy, you did study, legalese of the situation.
Oh, yeah, then we learned the code there. We had to copy, I think, 15 words. But then we had all the procedures, from to the little merchant marine procedures, not too much of them, maybe the DE, problems that you just need. Then you were saying about exchanging calls, but I was very frowned on the Coast Guard. When they work with, especially between Coast Guard ships and also any ship, with this lingo, the operators, they used to GM for good morning, GM for good night, OM for old man, or something like that. It's highly frowned on.
You had your Z signals in those days.
We had Z signals.
I had a hell of a time digging up all those old Z signals.
We used Navy Z signal. But the Merchant Marine had their own set of signals for different from ours.
Well, the next thing that the communications log show gets a little more confusing. Communication study is self-serving in the respect that it tries to explain the things that didn't come out right, and tries to not to bring up things, not turn over any more stones than necessary.
One of the reasons the things that didn't turn out right, I think that Baker's idea, or the captain's idea, was show how poorly planned the whole thing was as far as the ship was concerned. If there had been adequate planning in advance, it told us these things, that these things wouldn't have come up in the first place. Well, you might say it's self-serving, I just want to point out.
I didn't mean that in an offensive way of being. I'm just saying it's just human nature that a guy's going to put it in the light that looks most reasonable to him, and he's going to be slightly prejudiced. He may not have the golden tablets, and the truth might lie a little somewhere else. Anyway, the thing that came up all night long, and Tom O'Hare, who was on duty in the earlier part of the morning, he couldn't understand why he could hear her, but he'd call her and she wouldn't answer. He couldn't get anything out of her.
Well, that's the same thing we got. At that time, I thought, well, it's our transmitter. Maybe our transmitter's not working.
It still may be. We'll get into this a little later. But he kept... He thought it was kind of funny. So he asked Honolulu. He says... he asked Southside. He was in contact using the T-16 on 11360 or some, a high frequency. He asked them, hey, do you hear me on 3105? And they said, well, set a series of Bs. And so, so he'd switch over to 3105. He sent a series of Bs. They come back, no, we don't hear you at all. And they asked Honolulu, do you hear me? And Honolulu says, no, I don't hear you at all. And then he asked Tutila, and they didn't answer him. In the logs, it never did say whether they at all. He asked them if they heard him. They never answered him. So then later on, this went on for about an hour. He got busy with something else. Had a lot of communications going on. But he kept asking everybody if they heard him on 3105, and everybody kept telling him, "I don't hear you." And in fact, one time he asked Honolulu, Do you hear me? He says, do you hear Earhart? He says, yes, I hear her, but I don't hear you. Now, the logs, there's four other logs involved. Anthony set up a listening station at Coa Tower.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And they were monitoring all the frequencies. And their logs never heard you on 3105. Once in a while, they'd hear a carrier on 3105, but never any modulation. Well, I don't know. But also, now this is very important. In fact, I want to make sure this tape recorder's running. It's extremely important. And this is the reason I've been looking for Frank Cipriani. Cipriani was keeping logs.
Well, he was sure.
Right.
Yeah, he had the high frequency production, I'm sure.
And he was monitoring 3105, and he was keeping logs. And the strange part of Cipriani's logs are he heard you. He started his watch at 10 o'clock at night. And then, if you remember correctly, what you used to do was you drift off the island to the west. And as a matter of fact, the ship's logs show, and when you stood up to the island in the morning, we can recalculate back and figure out how far off. Word.
Well, no, that's not quite true in this case. our normal resupply of the islands, that's what we did. But, the sundown, shut down the engine, we had a very strong westerly set. Then along 1 or 2 in the morning, we'd start picking up slow speed back to the islands because they were unlit. Shoshone had run aground, I guess, the other. But this particular time, in order to be sure we stayed fairly close to the island, we built a big bonfire up on the northwest corner of the island. So we maneuvered to keep in sight of that. We picked up the fire. We did a couple of nights, but we didn't drift off. Normally we drift maybe as much as 40, 45 miles.
But you,
in anticipation that she would want maybe home in on us.
Okay, the logs, the ship, the deck log. Now, of course, the smooth log may not show all of everything that's on the rough log, but probably does. Usually any time the engines are started or stopped, it shows on the logs, and any time you stand, on a gyro heading wire or compass heading wire, shows in the log.
Yeah.
And it shows that you probably were in sight, but you were pretty far out. It shows you were about five and a half to seven miles.
Oh, that's correct. But as I say, it wasn't our normal service.
Well, sometimes you drift away. Well, in fact, one time he spent all the next day trying to find the island again.
Right.
Okay.
We stayed as close as we could in order to for us to home, for her to home in on us fairly close to the island.
Okay, now Cipriani's logs show that night that he heard you for a while, and then one of several alternatives you would think about the logs comes in. One, he was listening, but he didn't hear you anymore. He wasn't maintaining a watch, or he wasn't maintaining his logs. Because from about 11 o'clock at night, when after you drifted off the island, until about back to 5:30 in the morning when you stood up to the island, there's no entry in the log showing that he heard you on 3105. He has entries, but nothing from the Itasca.
Well, it might be, as I say, it's my conjecture, that we didn't get word that she had taken off until fairly late. That he might have secured his watch because we hadn't had any word she'd taken off.
No, he knew she was coming on. And as a matter of fact, he probably didn't secure his watch because this became the big problem the next morning. Do you remember why he couldn't get a bearing on her?
No, I can't remember.
Okay.
Somebody said that the battery went out, but I never remember the battery going out. But I might be that.
Well, when Black...
I think that's quite a statement. O'Hare claims the batteries didn't go out, and here's a communications officer. He doesn't remember anything about any batteries going out, and I don't know. There it is, Roseworth. I'll just continue. So I'll just start the tape again and let it run.
Lieutenant Cooper brought this direction finder down to the ship, which they borrowed from the Navy. Actually, Black had been the one that...
I always saw that.
I think Anthony would help them find it. They didn't bring any batteries with it. And, of course, it was a portable. It was battery-operated. So, you remember on the 5-inch gun turret, in order to light the indices and also for the alternate firing mechanism, the bell or the buzzer or whatever it was, they had a battery mounted right on the carriage.
Yeah.
So they took that battery and took it ashore with it. But remember, there was one always being charged and one on the carriage.
Right.
So they took the one either out of the carriage or the one off the charger, I don't know which, and took it ashore to operate the direction finder. And unfortunately, by the time she got there the next morning, he'd run the battery down, and finally he had secured the station. There wasn't any juice to run anything anymore. And do you remember where he was set up?
I want to say he was set up not too far from the hut. That would be on the southwest part of the island.
Do you remember if he was set up in a tent?
That I don't remember. I think he must have been.
You don't have that picture by any chance?
I don't have it with me. I found a picture of a tent set up near the intersection of the runways and a long wire antenna running up to a pole back over towards the government house. That's the only thing I can think that fence of being where Cipriani set up his direction finder. The boys claim he wasn't with them.
Oh, I know he wasn't with the boys. But himself.
And this brings up another problem. Well, anyway, I want to stay right with that him not hearing you. This becomes important because Johnson was giving you all sorts of static about your antennas. And that you weren't putting out well, and this, that, and the other thing. And Bellart's, and I guess you were involved, I'm sure you were involved too, that you tried, he wanted you to try a double A antenna or something, and he had you fiddling with the antennas and whatnot, and you finally sent messages under Thompson's signature, you know, bear with us, we can read Tuckerton every night. You know, our antennas can't be all that bad, and our signal strength from Honolulu and Tutuila is good, you know, and the ship's been operating for 4 or 5 years now. Why don't you just leave us alone and let the thing go? But you were fiddling with the antennas for a couple of days.
I believe we were.
And the thing that keeps bothering me is that Amelia never heard you on 31, never acknowledged ever hearing you on 3105. She acknowledged hearing you on 7500. Now, there's several reasons that this could be true. No one ever heard you on 3105 for the time being. During the flight and whatnot, no one ever heard you on 3105. People heard her, but no one ever heard the Itasca, including Cipriani, who's sitting on shore, and he has in his logs. Have you ever seen his logs?
No, I
know. Oh, I'm sure you did.
I did at the time.
Anyway, I think it would probably be wise for me to just pull this out right now.
Yeah, that'll bring back memory.
And Amelia was on Greenwich time.
Makes it complicated.
Yes. Matter of fact, that's one of the things that came out of all this, that in an emergency, everybody go to Greenwich time. It got so confusing, nobody knew who was talking about what when. As a matter of fact, does it occur to you a problem in these communications? Because she is on Greenwich time and you're on 11 and a half zone time?
Well, I don't think so. We were on her all the time, though, when the case of missing schedules were.
It caused real problems, because here she says, go ahead with the count either now or on the scheduled time on the half hour.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Or she says, give me a bearing and answer on the scheduled time on the hour. And you know what they did? They waited until the hour.
Mm-hmm. And she was keeping Greenwich.
When you were transmitting, she wasn't listening. And when she was listening, you weren't transmitting.
Yeah,
can you imagine that? Just a simple thing like that?
Stupid, you know. But see, we weren't big international people in those days, you know. You were on a ship. The ship was the ship. That was all.
But you could easily see how that could happen.
Well, on ships we always use Greenwich
local time.
No, Greenwich.
Not in those days. The radio logs are in 11 and a half zone. Yep. Here's Cipriani. He's on plus his computer zone plus 10 and a half. And here's the ship's logs.
What I'm talking about is our messages are filed on GMT.
You mean like 2135?
Yeah, 2135. That would be. But you don't have the message.
I don't. I have it with me here. No.
Well, the messages start out with the day of the month, and the last four is Greenwich time.
You know, radio logs. Soon after this, all went to Greenwich, but ship's radio logs were, at this time, being kept in local time.
No, I'm talking about our messages.
Yeah.
When we filed messages, they put the Greenwich time on.
Well, here's Cipriani's logs, and the interesting part about this is that he started his watch here, and he started right off... wrong date, and it's, but you know, when you get on an island and you're by yourself, and you didn't have date watches in those days, he got the wrong day, and he about the kindest thing you can say is he never knew what day it was.
Maybe we ought to go into, did you know Cipriani very well, and what was he like, and was his age at the time?
I didn't know him very well. See, we picked him up in Honolulu. He was a second class radioman. He had been given instruction.
That's the end of side one of tape number three. W.L. Sutter, I'll switch it over and we'll do side two now.
Bellows, but
yeah,
he wouldn't have had,
no
hardly
hair,
had
no
any
hair.
Contact.
Yeah, they probably knew each other pretty well.
Well, here's his logs, and he starts, and it says, of course, this is a transcript. I have never seen the originals. I don't know what, if anything, happened to him. But Frank Cipriani on the Howland Island, standing by to take bearings on 3105 on Earhart Plain. Assumed watch at 2200, time zone plus 10 and a half. And weak phone on 3105, unreadable at 2345. And then he, July 3rd, it should be July 2nd, but he wrote down July 3rd. He says, weak phone on 3105. I am using a long, this is at 0015. I'm using a long vertical antenna for reception of signals only, unable to get bearings. Then he says here, a task of testing with NMC on phone at 0215. It's just not so.
But he didn't put down the frequency.
Well, he's on 3105 only.
Oh, yeah, he put 3105.
Yeah. Right, at that point, it's the only frequency he's on.
But this would indicate that we were putting out on 3105.
It would, except for one thing.
And down here, it's, we were putting out on 3105.
Now, he says you were testing with NMC at this time, and you were not.
Of course, we were only 10 miles away from him, so.
Then but then he doesn't hear another thing between 0215 and 0, or I should say there's no entry in the log between 0. You stood up to the island at 0500.
Oh.
And there was transmissions all night long on 3105 from you. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why he put you were testing with NMC on phone at that time, because
you're going to be out of range on our phone, 3105, and that's maybe night effect. We're getting too tone.
Okay, then he picked up Earhart S3, but one, and these times do check. You were transmitting, just like he shows, from the time you stood up to the island until 7:15 in the morning, his log jives with your log. But I wonder what happened between here and here. I wonder if you might have got a couple, 3 hours sleep. That would be understandable. I mean, he's been up all day and all night, and pretty boring sitting out there all by yourself, and nobody's watching.
22. Yeah, she knew if she was airborne when he made his first entry.
Yeah, that's why you put him ashore. You actually found out about, I think it was about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
This I can't understand, charging batteries all day.
Well,
the only battery charger I remember they had ashore was a windmill battery charger.
They had a little gas generator they brought down.
Oh, they did?
Just before. A little gas-driven generator that charged back. And let's see here, he said, picked up Earhart using long loop, hardly any carriage, seemed over-modulated, switched over to loop for bearing. Whenever he goes to loop for bearing, it goes down to S1 to 0. She stopped transmission, bearing nil. Worked a task requesting bearing on plane. That's correct. All that's correct. Task ascending blind to Earhart. Now, this seems like a strange thing for a man to write in a radio log ahead of time. I mean, without... It looks like hindsight to me rather than something someone would write in a log. Now, her carrier is completely modulated and could not get a bearing to above reasons.
Doesn't sound right.
It doesn't sound right. No, it doesn't mean anything. It's an excuse. It's not a reason. It's just something popped into his head or somebody's head. I don't know.
If it was overmodulated, I could see maybe.
Well, you know, You would be using, if it's a A3 or voice signal, you'd be throwing on a BFO anyway,
and it
just doesn't make any difference. And a task of sending A's to Earhart, all right on down the line. This all matches the log, really.
Another inconsistency now is batteries are so weak. How's he
listen until here. Said using DF and receiving said sparing due to heavy drains on batteries. But then he still got said sparing, but he's using his receiver all the time.
Goes along for another hour or so.
Yeah, he uses his receiver when he says he's supposed to be using his
sparing. Of course, the T-22, which he was using to communicate the ship with, had its own battery supply. So
that's right.
Well, anyway, finally, at 9:26, before her last transmission, he's completely out of batteries. He's not receiving anything. You know, he says all batteries on the island are discharged and commence to charge them at 10 o'clock. This is not so because you're actually working the Geyser Government House, and of course all their equipment's battery operated, and did work them all that day and all that night. When he says all batteries on the island, he must be referring to his battery on the island is discharged.
That's the end of side one of tape number 6, review of communications. I'll turn it over and we'll continue on side 2.